Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
Hello there, you're very welcome along. So we're reviewing the Sunday papers. We're streaming on Facebook Live as well. Good to have you with us on YouTube. We have Paul Rouse in studio from the School of History at UCD, Professor Paul Rouse, former Offaly manager as well as of last year. And we have Declan Lynch as well from the Sunday Independent, a regular here, along with Paul, and author of Tony 10 as well, which is coming out in paperback very soon.
Yeah, in about a month's time, kind of around Cheltenham time, appropriately enough.
Yeah.
So, looking forward to that.
Yeah. Right, it's been well received.
It has indeed, yeah. It's been a real kind of pleasure in the sense that, I mean, for Tony, it was such a risk to do the book, you know, for several reasons. Mm. First of all, because just going back into all that terrible stuff, into the worst thing of his life, just personally was difficult. And also, you know, you never know how something like that will be received, you know. And so for him, it's been great. And it's done really well. I mean, literally, it was sold out. There's no more of them left out there after Christmas. So this is why they're bringing it out again. And we've just got a great reaction to it and delighted with it, really, you know.
You wrote about it. You loved it.
I should say before I say this, I don't know Declan. I met Declan once before, so I don't have any skin in this game. I've written this previously. It is the best sports book that I read last year, and I think it's one of the best sports books I ever read. And I think it is more than that. It's a really, really, it shines a light on a huge issue in Irish life in a way that nobody has done it before. It's a brilliant book.
Well, with that recommendation.
Thank you.
Check it out. So we'll start with the headlines and then we'll get stuck into various stories. Feel good factor, Phil Foden scoring for Manchester City against Newport yesterday at Rodney Parade, a 4-1 win. And then Manchester United fans, you'll see here, Manchester United are prepared to pay David De Gea $90 million over his next 5 years. So $350,000 a week sterling is what they're willing to give David De Gea to keep him. It's what he's asked for, and they don't think it's unreasonable. It's been talked about as the largest basic pay package. Obviously, there's image rights and various other bonuses which go with contracts. But just in terms of basic pay, this is bigger than the Sanchez contract, bigger than the Pogba contract. So David De Gea in for a big payday if he decides to accept that. Back of the Mail on Sunday, dream killer Foden, Amund on target. That's Borg Amund, the Carlo man, Amund on target, but there's no FA Cup shock as Man City march on. It was a 4-1 win. Sun Sport, I've got to man up. This is Alexis Sanchez, who is accepting that he is not playing well enough for Manchester United. Interestingly here, they have his wages at 505,000 sterling a week, which is more than I ever saw it reported as. I always thought it was in the realm of 300 or 350. So that just was noticeable. Back page of the Sunday Mirror, roll of the die. So it seems, according to John Richardson on the back page of the Mirror, that Old Trafford Chiefs have already opened talks with Juventus over a potential move for Paulo Dybala, Juventus. So that would be good news for Manchester United. There's talk of Lukaku going the opposite direction, by the way, in that deal. And more transfer business. Back page of the Star. João Félix, 19 years of age, plays for Benfica. It seems Manchester United and PSG are in for him. He's been talked about as the next Cristiano Ronaldo. £105 million is the price in that tug of war. Then the Sunday Independent, completely different tone, really, when it comes to all the transfer stories. It's Mullinocta's Aidan McGilligut distraught after they were beaten by Dr. Crokes yesterday. Although Eamon Sweeney making the point that in Currafin and Crokes, we have two of the really great football teams in this country, and you could do a lot worse on Paddy's Day than to go and watch these football. Currafin and Crokes make Gaelic football look like the most beautiful game of all, is how Eamon Sweeney starts that piece. And then finally, it seems Ole Gunnar Solskjaer had a three-hour meeting with Ed Woodward. It seems it's happening regardless of how this week goes. He understands, Solskjaer, that he will be the next Manchester United manager, has the total support of Alex Ferguson. There was a three-hour meeting with Woodward, and that looks like it's happening. £4 million per year deal as United boss. That's the back page of the Sunday World. So there we are. There are your back pages. Lots to get through on the Sunday papers this afternoon. We might start, good Offaly man that you are, with Shane Lowry, a two-page spread with Paul Kimmich. Definitely the biggest interview across all the Sunday papers. Really, in broad terms, it's Shane Lowry who recently won in the Middle East. It was a huge win for him. 3 years on, almost 2.5 years on from August 2016, when he had a four-shot lead going into the final round of the US Open, and things went awry for him. So the comeback kid is how this is done. Big two-page spread there. Great picture of Shane, and Kimmage sat down with him at Pebble Beach last week to reflect on the horror of losing his four-shot lead at the US Open and what the fallout has been like.
So I said I don't know Declan, and I don't really know Shane Lowry. I met him a couple of times at Offaly football matches, very, very briefly. I am entirely biased here. I've nothing but respect and regard and admiration. I'm lost in admiration for Shane Lowry, for the way he conducts himself, for the way he goes about it, for his openness in what he wants to say. When he wants to say something, he says it. When he wants to do something, he does it. But he's a hugely impressive person, apart from being obviously a brilliant golfer. Mm. I happened to be in America in June 2016, working in Boston when he had that lead in the US Open. And I've probably argued a lot with people since then who've talked about how he choked and how he, you know, he blew up. Mm. I don't think he choked at all. I don't think he blew up. I think it comes down to it, he just didn't play well when it came down to it. Mm. And he started steadily. He didn't start brilliantly, but he started steadily. Mm. And he was there going into the last 7-8 holes. He was in and around the lead. There was always going to be a charge coming from somewhere. Yeah. He'd never been in that position before. Mm. He fought hard. And when it came down to it, he just did not play well enough. Mm. In a stretch of holes in the back. And he's totally open about how it happened, what happened to him. And it's a really interesting interview. It's a really interesting story. And he talks about things that he might have done differently.
Yeah. Not least on the second, it was a drivable par four. He scrambled a par on the first. He felt very nervous. He talks about feeling very nervous on that morning. And he scrambled a par, which was good. And then on the second, it's drivable par four. And he was driving the ball brilliantly, he said. And everybody, you know, he looked back at the coverage. Everybody was taking the chance of driving the ball. And he didn't drive it, even though he was driving the ball really well. And he ended up making a bogey, and that rattled him. And he bogeys four of the first 10 holes. You're still tied for the lead on 12. And he says, yeah, but when you start with a four-shot lead, that feels horrific. He says, I've watched it back on TV. And there's a quote he has where he's talking to his caddy, Dermot. Everything seems to be happening so quick, and I couldn't understand why. And before I knew it, I was standing on the 18th and the tournament was over. That's his recollection almost of the whole afternoon. He three-putted the 14th, the 15th and the 16th. On the whole choking point, I don't think I choked, he says. You don't? Long pause. It feels like it, says Paul Kimmage. It probably looks like it. Does it feel like it? He says, I don't know. What are you supposed to feel? Did I play the last 10 holes in four over? Yes. But it's one of the toughest golf courses in the world, one of the toughest scenarios you can face. I was hitting the ball well. My putter left me for 9 holes. That's where I lost it. I don't think I choked. I just didn't go out and win. That's his perspective on it.
Yeah, I mean, it's great stuff. It's a really brilliant interview. It's just a kind of classic Paul Kimmage interview, because he taught, first of all, he goes, you know, what's the big story about Shane Ross not winning the US Open?
There's lots of big stories about Shane Ross.
Yeah. Sorry, thank you, pardon. Shane Lowry. Oh, dear God.
Easy to confuse the two. Very similar types.
They're extraordinarily similar people, as we all know. Anyone could make a mistake like that. So I think that the thing that sticks out here is just how traumatic it was for him. One way of looking at it is, you know, well, okay, he didn't win the US Open, but he did so well to get there. It was his first real time in contention for a major, and a lot of people would not feel so, but it really was a huge blow for him, it seems, at the time. And, you know, Paul Kimmage really teases that out And it was where they're discussing like what the meaning of the word choke, you know. And there's a whole psychology to do that. It's like saying the word the yips. You know, golfers simply don't mention the word because it's so damaging and there's so much weight attached to it.
The Lord Voldemort of golf.
It is, yeah. You simply don't say it. So they're going in, they're jousting there about that. Did he choke or did he not, you know. Mm. But there's almost a sense of it being this being therapeutic, this interview. Eventually it gets to the point where he reaches rock bottom with his caddy. He parts company with his caddy, I think Dermot Byrne.
Yes, Dermot Byrne, yeah. And at the British Open during the summer just gone.
And that they have a kind of a falling out ultimately. Things are going really badly for Larry. And
I'm not actually, because people will be interested. The first round at Carnoustie, I got off to a decent start, made a couple of mistakes. And then me and Dermot Byrne's caddy, we tried to have a chat after the round. It turned into an argument. I threw my toys out of the pram. I left the golf course, didn't do any practice. He came up to the house that night and we finished it. It was the hardest thing I've ever had to do. And Neil Manship, his coach, caddied for him the next day. Larry says, yeah, that was wrong. Kimmich says not to have waited until after the tournament. And Larry says, yeah, stupid, I regret that. But another thing with me is I hate confrontation. I can't deal with it. Yeah. So he almost couldn't bring himself to face
it. Yeah, he has the classic structure of, like, you know, he has the trauma. He goes through a bad period. He hits the ultimate rock bottom. And then he returns with this great win, you know, a few weeks ago.
There's quite a poignant moment where Kimmich says to him, earlier on in the piece, before they discussed the breaking up of that caddy-player relationship, which was basically a decade long. I spoke to Dermot last year, he said, for a piece I was writing on caddies. He said the thing he remembered most about your second place finish at Oakmont was driving to New York the next day. He was crying so hard he had to stop several times. He ended up missing his flight. Larry says, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I thought that was really hard to read, actually. And there's an, I'd throw in beside that, that on the Tuesday morning after the event, after we'd lost on the Sunday, Shane Lowry talks himself about how he woke up on the Tuesday morning and just absolutely broke down. Mm. But the question is, what was he doing on the Monday? And what he was actually doing on the Monday was he was at Royal Dublin Golf Club and he was doing a golf clinic and had to play 18 holes with the sponsors, HNA, of the French Open. Mm. So he had to actually go to work the next day on the Monday.
Yeah.
In the most prosaic manner possible.
Yeah.
With his going on in the background, having just imploded on in all his dreams crushed in those last nine holes, and he goes to do this. Mm. And that relationship with Dermot Byrne, it must have been, it obviously they were very, very close, and the fallout from that must have been pretty hard. But he the way he talks then about how his brother came in the bag for him. Mm. Later on in 2017, and things are moving on, you can see, like, he's not trying to blame anybody else here. He's acknowledging straight out that he didn't behave particularly well.
Yeah.
Mm. with Dermot Byrne, and like that, again, that's admirable. Mm.
I think that strikes me as well, just on the point of, like, yeah, how badly it affected him. You see, like, Shane Lowry is a top class golfer, and you know, obviously abundantly talented. So he wasn't like a guy who kind of gets a lucky streak for a few days and will never, you know, have any chance of winning a major again. We've had those guys, you know, the guys who kind of lead the British Open after one day. I think it's Peter Jacobson or something has a great quote about, as the slums of Chicago are full of guys who led the Masters after the first day, you know. And if a guy like that suddenly gets a chance to win, you know he'll never remotely come near it again. Whereas, you know, Shane Lowry is like a top class player. Mm. So again, it puzzles me a little bit just how devastating it was for him.
Four shot lead, though.
Well,
four
shot lead. He will be there again. You know, I mean, his, you know, someone of that talent since would be have a fair chance of being there again.
They would, like, yeah. That, you know, he'd have a reasonable expectation.
Better than some other people.
But he may even win a major.
Yeah, that's easy
and
for
may
me.
Not, yeah, and may not lead by four shots going that's into the right. final round again.
Of course, yeah. You and know? It's easy for me kind of sitting here.
Well, of course, it's easy for us all. Yeah. He turned to Gerry Hussey as well. Sports psychology, definitely not for him, it seems. He talks about how he's not on Twitter anymore. I love Twitter, but I don't use my account anymore. Brian Moran, his manager, does that for me. I can't deal with the negativity. It's just poison. People slagging you off and telling you how shite you are, and then other people licking your arse is something you don't need as well. Which is a pretty good summary of, I would think, being a sports star on Twitter.
Well, he doesn't need to be on it.
No.
So why would he bother?
He checked it the morning of the US Open as well. It seemed, Kimmage even says to him, it sounds like from a psychological point of view, you did everything wrong the morning of the US Open, because he was checking Twitter and he could see the whole country was blowing up because he had shot a 65 in the third round. That morning it was an early start and everybody knew he was four shots clear. And also his dad was there and it was Father's Day and he kind of pretty emotional about what it would mean to give the trophy to his dad. Like Kimmage says to him, I'm surprised you could lift a club.
But that's the way he is. Like he can only be himself. As he goes on like this, if it suits him to look at Twitter, if it's if you're trying to win it for your dad. I mean, I know that doesn't suit a whole load of people, and it might be entirely outside what sports psychologists would expect you to do.
Yeah.
But so what?
Yeah.
I like that this quote sticks out as well. Larry says, "I don't like change. I'm not a big person for change. I have the same manager and the same coach and had the same caddy for 9 years. I wish more people would say that, you know. Change, I mean, from politicians sticking it as a slogan of change, everything change. There's this automatic, everything to do with change is regarded as good.
Yeah.
Whereas there's also an argument that the change that a lot of us need is to change things back to the place before they were changed. Mm. Do you know what I mean? If we could do that, it might help, you know. But just to come out and say, I don't like change is, I think, refreshing in an odd sort of way.
So that's Larry. That's on pages 2 and 3 of the Sunday Independent. And it's great now. Look, he's after winning at the start of this year. It puts him back in the world's top 50. He says that he knows Padraig Carrington's not going to pick him. You'll have to qualify for the Ryder Cup. He says, yeah, I know. They're not going to give picks to rookie these days. And Larry says, yeah. And he'd be slower to pick one of his friends as well because he'd be setting himself up for a fall. So
I also thought he should have been picked. It could have been, was it maybe the Ryder Cup before last?
When Darren Clarke was captain.
Yeah, and he wasn't picked, right? Mm. And there was some talk that he might have been picked. I think it would have been great to pick him. I think he would have been a brilliant Ryder Cup player. Just even, it might have given him a real
That was the year of the Open. That was the year the US Open, wasn't it? That was 2016.
Yeah. As he said himself, he only needed to play half decent after the US Open to be in the team, but he went off a cliff.
But even so, it's the sort of thing that maybe it could have sparked something in him, you know?
Yeah, I can't remember who Clarke picked. He certainly picked Lee Westwood, which blew up badly in his face. I can't remember all the picks. On as we part the golf, at the complete other end of the spectrum, back page of the Sunday Times, David Walsh is writing about Matt Kuchar. Kuchar's caddy should have been paid the going rate. I suspect lots of you have seen this story. In short, Matt Kuchar, one of those smiley, easy-to-like pro golfers, as Walsh calls them, was playing in Mexico at the Mayakoba Golf Classic last November. He hadn't won in 4 years at that stage. His career earnings are $46 million, we should say. But so he used a local caddy in Mexico because his own usual caddy was unavailable. Ortiz, David Ortiz was his name. So they agreed that he'd give him $1,000 if he missed the cut, $2,000 if he made it, $3,000 if he finished in top 20, and $4,000 for a top 10. They never actually discussed what they would do if he won. And then he went and won $1.26 million. And Kuchar gave him $5,000. The going rate for a full-time caddy who's on the road, which would be 10%, i.e. $100,000. Kuchar gave him $5,000. Thought this thing would go away, and it's after blowing up in the last 2-3 months in just the most unbelievable way. And Kuchar had a statement during the week where he kind of said, look, $5,000 for this guy, you know, I kind of think someone, he got in his car, he makes $200 a day usually. $5,000 is a really big week, is what Kuchar said this week, as a way of trying to justify it.
You know, they'll only waste, you know, what they, you know, there's no point giving these guys money, you know, they don't know what to do with it.
Wow. The reaction to that was so horrific. Who knows what sponsors got involved or who came involved, but Kuchar released another statement saying, frankly, I made comments that were out of touch and insensitive. He's agreed he's going to give Ortiz the $50,000. Though the point is, and this is Walsh's point, you know, the question is, should you give Kuchar credit for rectifying the situation, or do you remember him for his miserliness? And Walsh, I think, rightly says, it's the latter that is going to stick in
but
the mind.
It's just symptomatic of a culture, right? Like, we all love the old golf joke, you know what I mean?
Sure,
like,
it's a great
watch
sport,
it, you know, and all that. But the PGA, particularly, the culture, the corporate culture of the PGA is vile, vile beyond belief. It's the kind of sporting wing of the far right in America. You've got the NRA, the GOP, and the PGA.
Yeah.
They're vile, right? And this is so symptomatic of a culture, you know, that is in which I think the Colin Kaepernick, the take a knee, I think one professional golfer sort of ranked number 857 or something, supported him or made a statement in support of him, right? This is the culture that these guys are coming from. So it's as normal as breathing for Matt Kuchar to be issuing these kind of disgraceful sort of view of the world, really. And even when he gives him the fifth, why not give him the 100 grand, for God's sake? Yeah, you know, yeah. I mean, how hard would that be? So he calls a penalty on himself. It's not much of a penalty, really, is it? He's calling on himself. I mean, he's calling maybe half a penalty. Mm. You know, maybe it should be a 2-shot penalty and he's only calling 1 shot.
Do you know what? Go all out to try and redeem yourself and say, do you know what? I've made 46 million. I made such a mess of this. Here's the million.
That's exactly what I was thinking. I think he looks mean and there is nothing attractive
you
about
me. You still paid the minimum amount. 50,000 is now the next new minimum.
He'd been dragged through a ditch to pay it.
Yeah.
It looks shocking. It's incredibly revealing though of attitudes. Yeah. And it's a really serious... And David Walsh does ask the question, do you remember him for rectifying the situation? Which he doesn't really rectify, by the way. He kind of half rectifies it. Or remember him for his miserliness. I don't know, I think the answer is easily the second.
Yeah. I mean, it's now a byword for being cheap. If you're playing golf with someone and they don't buy the coffees that they have to buy because they lost the round, they're going to call the Matt
Kuchar.
Well, I think Kuchar as well, doesn't he come from a really well-off family? Like, you know, they're kind of, again, sort of in financial services, shall we say, you know? So, I guess, you know, his whole life, he would have formed the view that there are certain people that, you know, have money and other people don't, and that's fine.
There's the help.
It's a complete mess. I saw someone tweeting that when the commentators now usually explain that the crowd aren't booing, they're just saying "cooch." Who knows anymore? You know, but it's just unbelievable. So he's given the $50,000, but no one feels good about it. I don't think anymore. You know, he can't feel good about giving the $50,000. So that's the golf done with. Declan Rice has been a big talking point all week. I suspect people have pretty much reached the point of having their fill of it. So there's a few, though, writing about it in the Sunday papers. We won't spend too long on this, but we'll give you a sense of what people are saying. Eamon Sweeney, I thought it a very strong piece, "Stop this sneaky pursuit of players." He says, "The story of Declan Rice is a very simple one. It's the tale of a young Englishman who, believing he wasn't good enough to be capped for his own country, threw in his lot with Ireland at underage level. On discovering that he was much better than he'd initially thought, he switched allegiance to his native land. His decision was neither dishonourable nor surprising. There's no need to complicate things with waffle about the conflicted soul of the immigrant. No need to try and find someone to blame." And then he goes on to talk about how Ireland are chief practitioners when it comes to luring over players born elsewhere. Other countries do the same thing. None do it to the same extent as the Republic. Perhaps that is why there's such a strong desire to pretend that cynical pragmatism is in fact something else. That this stretching of the nationality rules to the very limit is a kind of Mary Robinson candle extended to the immigrant masses. To continue this pretense, it would help to just nab one player who was good enough to play for England and opted for us instead. Declan Rice was that player, which is why his defection is a psychological blow for reasons besides his considerable footballing ability. The argument that there's some irreducible core of paddiness which makes you essentially Irish, even if your grandparents left the country 60-odd years ago, strikes me as a dubious one. There's something humiliating about the Rice saga, and talks about Grealish as well. He says that they both show that no top-class English-born player will ever pledge his senior future to Ireland. It is our fate to function as a kind of consolation prize for the Redmonds and Bamfords of this world.
Yeah, I mean...
Does he have a point?
Yeah, absolutely. And Tommy Conlon, my favourite bit, you know, that was added to the rich mixture of the week, because he was just referred to John Delaney as Jilted John, which brought something to it. I think there's a link as well with everything about Gordon Banks. You know, when people are talking about Gordon Banks playing for St. Pat's against Rovers when he was nearly 40, right? Just that culture of great, immortal footballers who were still found like 500 quid to be quite handy towards the end of their days, right? Who were completely not looked after, who lived in an era in which you know, I know John Giles is always, he's the most measured of men, right? Mm. The one thing that really still gets him going is that whole issue where someone like Wilf Mannion was getting 20 quid a week while 60,000 people were coming through the turnstiles. It's gone completely the other direction now, okay? But, like, I'm still okay with Wayne Rooney getting the money rather than, say, Martin Edwards.
Yeah.
So it hasn't actually swung in exactly the opposite direction. It's still a better direction. But the maltreatment and basically the abuse of talented people by the people who ran football for so long, you know, it's instilled in football. There's in the DNA, in the very kind of core of the professional footballers now, is the fact that you never do anything other than for your own self-interest. You just don't do things for sentimental reasons. Mm. And I think that is, it's such a deeply held kind of position that why we're even thinking that someone like Jack Grealish or Declan Rice will do otherwise, we're like children. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The world changed. Once the likes of Nobby Stiles was selling his medals for that in 1966, all that stuff, that these scandalous situations, right? You know, in the professional footballer, an iron, you know, core was developed that, like, you know, you get nothing for sentimentality in football, and you always go with the. You know, where the money is, you always go for the kind of, for self-interest, you know, for your greater self-interest. And so it's so normal that he's doing this. And you have to see, and once you see it in that history, just oddly enough that Banks died this week. And, you know, again, probably struggled to make a living most of his life. Make a living. I mean, just pay the bloody gas bill or whatever.
I totally understand people will be a bit put off by the fact he played 3 times for Ireland. It leaves a terrible taste, and you kind of think he shouldn't have done that if he had any sense that he wasn't going to see it out in the long run. But I think we do have to look at ourselves here. So, like, Stephen Hunt is making the point, for instance, that he saw Rice playing for the first time for West Ham when he was in the reserves 18 months ago, and so we've missed an opportunity, as in we could have almost got him in the team sooner. And Sweeney advocates a position I totally agree with, which is, you know, there is something really sneaky and pragmatic about what we're doing. So he says, on I guess Stephen Hunt's point, that sneakiness, it's obvious in all those calls to give Rice a competitive cap as quickly as possible so that he'd be stuck with us for good. We were essentially trying to hoodwink a teenager in the hope that he'd make a hasty decision before realising the extent of his own ability. It was shabby stuff. Declan Rice copped onto us before it was too late. Fair play to you, me old China.
I'm not sure if it works out like that. So, I mean, if you look back, say Mark Lawrenson is a famous example.
Yeah.
Who I think it was Alan Kelly, the goalkeeper,
got him early at Preston. Yeah.
But nobody. I mean, Mark Lawrenson was okay with that throughout his career. I mean, he was.
I'm sure Declan Rice would have been okay with it. But is it right that we're doing it?
Yeah.
Nobody
knows for sure if someone is going to be a great star or not. So there's always that doubt, I think, at a certain stage. And like the blame is absolutely with Martin O'Neill and Roy Keane, like that they didn't see that. And if you give him the cap, he plays, and it doesn't become it's not an issue anymore. You're not taking advantage of him. I don't think it's your job. You know what I mean? If you're an international manager, your job is to do whatever is in the best interest.
Isn't there something of the country? Isn't there something wrong though? Let's use Sweeney's word of hoodwinking a teenager. Say Declan Rice had made a competitive start for Ireland when he was 17, 18.
Yeah.
And then deep down, he regretted that on some level for the rest of his life. Would we feel great about the fact that we had
accept. I know exactly what Eamon is saying there, but someone like Declan Rice, he's not Messi. Do you know what I mean? It isn't massively obvious that he's going to be a really top-class player. There is an element of doubt at a certain stage there. And if you're the manager of Ireland, like, your job is to see promising players and have them playing for Ireland. So, like, that's their fault. Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think you're taking advantage of them as such. I mean, no more than anybody would have thought that you were taking advantage of Mark Lawrenson when, as it happened, he developed into this marvellous player. But and maybe playing international football helped him in that sense, you know. So it's just that the issue doesn't arise anymore. It's not an issue, you know. And you very rarely have examples of that, of someone who just finishes up playing with the wrong or regrets it deeply, you know, because it's so hard to know if someone is
really good. I mean, Declan Rice, if he had played for Ireland, and had a sterling career, no pun intended, he would never have come out and said after, you know, on winning his 50th or 100th Irish cap, it's been great and all, but to be honest, if I'd known things were going to go so well, I probably would have played of England. So we don't know how players feel privately. What's your take on it all?
I think I'd go a little bit wider than just soccer. I would look at the manner in which international sport operates, and at its margins, it's a farce. And we're talking here about soccer and how the FAI do their business and how the management of the Irish soccer team do their business. But what about the rugby team? Mm-hmm. And what about the Rugby Football Union, who has spent more than a decade or a decade identifying Southern Hemisphere players to come and play for Ireland? Mm. So 3 years in the country makes you qualified to play. At this, I know the rules have now been changed to five, but only recently. But the rules, as things have stood, mean that the Irish rugby team is essentially kind of supported by a series of players who've been brought from the Southern Hemisphere who don't qualify for citizenship for 5 years, but are identified as being Irish in sporting terms for 3 years. Mm. And we're happy when this goes against us to scream and shout. And I'll give you an example. In 2016 in the European Athletics Championships, Fionnuala McCormack was beaten into fourth place. And she's a brilliant runner.
Yeah.
And she was rightly raging after the match, or after the race. And she was raging because she'd been beaten by a Turk called Yasemin Khan into fourth place.
Yeah.
Yasemin Khan wasn't Yasemin Khan a few months previously.
Yeah.
She was actually a Kenyan woman
yeah.
who continued to run and train and live in Kenya, but ran for Turkey as Yasemin Khan. I mean, the rules are a farce. And people, there are two basic points here. The first is that international athletes are well capable in very many instances of making compromises around identity and nationality that will allow them to compete at the highest level mm-hmm. and to earn money. That's the first point. The second point is that if it works for the benefit of a team, supporters of that team are generally speaking willing to accommodate that. Broadly speaking, there's no real disagreement on it. Mm.
There is, though. I think there is disagreement. I don't think anybody likes the residency situation in Irish rugby, but there reaches a point where once the team are playing, you have a choice then, well, do I not support the team or do I support the team? And if I'm supporting the team, do I abstain when Bundiaki scores a try? No, of course you don't. Like, it's difficult territory then. You know, are you going to see the team as corrupted by the examples you're talking about and say, well, I'm just not going to support them at all?
I think there is no evidence of any decline in support for the Irish rugby team. It's a broader point I'm making.
That's sure.
So the point I'm making is that people accommodate themselves to success.
Yeah. And on the specifics, look, I agree with everything you're saying there. Like, the wider point, where we are in the margins, I mean, international competition is farcical
really,
at the moment. On the specifics of Rice, what do you make of Rice?
The last time we spoke about this in this studio, I think I didn't just predict, but I laid out clearly that he would definitely stay with Ireland, that there was no doubt that he would leave and go back to England, that he had nailed his colours to his mast, that he needed space, the kind of space that anybody might need. But of course, when time drifts along, he's entitled to change his mind in terms of his growing up.
Yeah.
Now, within the rules, he should not have been able to change his mind. Within the rules, once you play for a country, that's it. Really, when it comes down to it, that's the way it has to be. Mm. Now, for him, identity is a really, really complex thing. And you can feel more than one thing. He can feel, and I think he laid it out really well in the statement. It's a brilliantly crafted statement. He had fantastic advisors. His media people are brilliant. They put it together really well. Mm. And it is right. He feels himself to be a proud Englishman.
Yeah.
And at the same time, he has an Irish heritage, which he's proud of. And I think that exactly encapsulates the situation.
Mm.
And I would think there's another element which isn't in the statement and isn't widely commented on, and that is that when he was 15, 16, 17, his dad was incredibly excited that his son was playing for Ireland. And that, of course, is related to his own parents, Declan Rice's grandparents, and the kind of general sense of feeling around that. And there is no doubting the sincerity and pride that was felt around that family feeling.
Yeah.
But there's a difference between what a 16-year-old boy thinks and what a 19-year-old boy. He's moving out into the world. Mm. He's making it successfully in the Premier League. I take your point, Declan, that he hasn't proven he's going to be brilliant. I'd be really surprised if he's not a top, really seriously, he's not a really big club in the next couple of years. Stephen Hunt says that there's every chance Man United will buy him in the summer. I think that's right. Mm. I think he could be exactly what Man United need in that team. And he looks a class apart when he plays.
Yeah, no, he's a fine player. There's no doubt. Well, then so that's Rice and both of you. Then the FAI policy, which brings in James McCarthy when it works. Mm. You know, Scottish born. And blows up in our faces on occasion, i.e. with Rice and Jack Grealish. This policy of scouting cross-channel and finding players with Irish heritage and saying, come on over, see how you like us. Mm. Do you agree with that? Is that okay? Is that within... No, you're shaking your head?
No.
Yeah. I don't know. I see the world is an increasingly complicated place. Like, and, you know, a lot of the sort of the idea of nationality comes from a time when a lot of people would never leave the country they lived in for the whole of their lives. Do you know what I mean? So, like, there is a lot of mixed nationality, a lot of,
sure,
you know, just as the world becomes just the people, you know, travel more, basically. Mm. You know, so it is to some extent a reflection of that, I think, you know, that, you know, it is more normal for people to... to have someone who's entirely Irish in the sense that both of their parents were born and reared in Ireland, all this kind of thing is not as automatic as it used to be. You know what I mean? So it is a response to, in some sense, to that. I think just the nature of the world is such. I mean, if you look at the French team,
not a wholly cynical exercise. No.
Well, look at the French national team, the football team. You know what I mean? Their backgrounds, their nationalities are vastly more complex than they used to be in the days of Joost Fontaine or whoever used to play, the guys who used to play for France. Mm. You know, so you know, it does reflect that in a sense. And you know, I don't know how you respond to that except in the way the rules are, I suppose, accommodate that, and you just get on with it then, you know, and try not to make massive errors along the way.
Agree?
You
know?
Not fully, no. I think in the 19th century, for example, you look when international sport is being made and you look at the formation of the first Irish teams, there were more Irish people living in the cities of Boston and New York than there were living in Dublin. There were more Irish people living in London and Manchester than there were in Dublin. So I think these flows are not new. Mm-hmm. And I think what is entirely new, though, is essentially the identification of people to come and play for a country where they haven't lived or they don't have a really meaningful connection of heritage. And the problem with the rules is, I think, it's to actually design those rules is incredibly difficult.
Yes.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
No, that's true.
And what you're relying on is a certain integrity amongst the people. But as people know, when it comes to winning sports matches, sports competitions, integrity is pretty often cast aside and willingly cast aside by people.
Yeah, it's a great way of putting it. Yeah, that is where we are exactly. We'll take a short break. We're reviewing the papers here with Paul Rouse and Declan Lynch. Now, you're welcome back. We're here with Paul Rouse and Declan Lynch looking at the Sunday papers. So we'll move on to some GAA pieces. And actually, on that front, there's a piece on the Off the Ball website, offtheball.com, which is well worth a read, an interview with Paddy McNamara. It covers quite a few things. He was one of the hurlers who did play under Justin McCarthy when there was effectively a Limerick strike on. And he's very honest about what that experience was like and the loyalty he felt to McCarthy and the atmosphere in the county at the time. And it's worth checking out, Paddy McNamara, and it's on the Off the Ball website. So if you're a Limerick fan, if you're looking for some GAA pieces, that one is well worth checking out. And it's at offtheball.com. So it's an interview there with Paddy McNamara. You'll find it on the homepage. There were pieces that you lads picked out as well. GPA, clearly a well-run body, but are their demands sustainable? Philip Lanigan is writing here about the amount of money, frankly, in the GAA and where so much of it is going. And then Colm O'Rourke just wants to burst any bubble of enthusiasm. Don't get too carried away by February's phony wars. Yes, it was good, he says, of Dublin against Kerry. Both sides went at it, but it was talked up into something more than it was. Epic battles only happen when there's more at stake. Maybe it's a natural reaction when there are so few good games. The weekend was balanced by the other Division 1 matches, ranging from poor to rotten in the case of Galway-Monaghan. So thank God for small mercies. And he does say, most of the games in the last 30 years were raw enough. We're not blessed with too many great teams or great skill either. The essential change in the game has seen it become one of keeping possession with fewer contests for the ball. So that's O'Rourke not getting too excited about what we saw on offer in Tralee last year. And then the Philip Lanigan piece stems from a fairly informal briefing that Paul Flynn, now the CEO of the GPA, gave during the week, where he did fly the kite maybe that the GPA would go after 15% of GAA commercial income, which was valued at just over 2.94 million in 2018. Now, it's probably just the beginning of negotiations as well. You don't get the impression they're going to go hard at it. But Lanigan starts talking in his piece then about the madness of the intercounty spend generally. Broke into the 25 million mark in 2017 when all the counties were totted up together. Where do you want to start here, Paul?
Well, the GPA, the 15% of GAA's commercial income is already in place, valued at 2.94. What Paul Flynn was asked about was specifically
gate receipts,
which are currently excluded from the arrangement. And I think that would be on 2018 ticket sales worth around €1 million or so more. It's a very good piece by Philip Lanigan. It's a very fair piece. He quotes what John Prenti, the Connacht Council Secretary, calls the madness of an intercounty spend that broke 25 million in 2017. And I think the difficulty is for the GPA when they look for more money is that they're not great at factoring in costs into, they don't want the costs of running things subtracted from the revenue which is earned. And that's really a really difficult and very problematic thing. The GAA's balance sheet is ultimately supported by a vast voluntary endeavour across the countryside. And that's an undeniable fact. Mm-hmm. Now, as things stand, intercounty players get very, very good expenses, fine gear, fine. They're well looked after in almost every county and at almost every level. And that's fine. But there has to be a limit to that. And there particularly has to be an issue around prioritisation. Mm-hmm. And Michael Dignan makes exactly the right point in the piece above Philip Lanigan's piece, mm-hmm. where he talks about where are the GPA when it comes to talking about the club structures. Mm-hmm. And the GPA's answer is, well, we're there to represent county players. Well, every county player is a club player. Mm. And ultimately, the single greatest problem, we're not going to go down this road of talking about it, but the single greatest problem within the GAA is not more money being given to the GPA, it's the calendar of play. And the GPA has singularly failed to come up with any significant proposal as to how that calendar should be fixed. And you have a situation whereby inter-county competitions for 2019 began in 2018 at the beginning of December, and they will continue until just about September of this year. Mm. It's a calendar of play which is ridiculous. It drives costs to levels which are unnecessary, and it stops play, significant play, for more than 98% of the membership. Mm. And I think that's I think that's a key. If we move then to talk about Kerry Dublin, which I think is probably something people might be more interested in, it was a really interesting reaction to that match. I watched the match. I thought it was a good game. I didn't think it was quite the classic that it was. It shows you how desperate people are for a decent game of football. I thought Kerry were the better team. I thought they were well the better team on the night and they deserved to win. I would imagine that you would want to be extremely careful about reading too much into it. However, there are two things, I think, for Dublin. Mm. The first is that they have lost some incredibly brilliant players and replaced them with players who are very, very good, which means that they are slightly more vulnerable than they were previously, number one. Number two, there is an issue with a high ball into their full back line, which they are going to need to resolve. And there is an issue about who plays midfield with Brian Fenton. Mm.
On the GPA for a moment, and O'Rourke finishes off his article saying, it's great that we may, and he says the word is very much may, we may see some opposition to Dublin dominance this year. There's a lot of improvement to come from Kerry as well, and he says they'll need to improve a lot, even on that performance last week. On the GPA generally, have they been a force for good over the last decade?
In my view?
Yeah.
I don't think anybody can legitimately criticise the fact that inter-county players now get proper expenses and proper support for that. Mm. but as a force for good, I wouldn't see them. They're not an unequivocal force for good, far from it. I think there is an element of empire building in how they go about it, and it has led to a general skewing of commercial priorities within the association. It is emblematic of it, and they have driven it. So they're not just emblematic of it, they have also driven it in a particular way. And ultimately, they are the people who run the GPA are representing a very small percentage of the GAA's membership. And there is a story, a narrative, which is being created around the sacrifice and the great indentured slavery of the intercounty player that I don't really get it. To me, to play intercounty football and hurling is an enormous privilege, and I think it's viewed as such by a huge number of people who play it. Certainly, the ones that I know, they're incredibly decent fellas, and incredibly decent women. The ones I know from UCD who play at this level, they are very committed. They're often very committed to their clubs as well. And they're having the time of their lives in very many respects. Now, there are downsides to it which need to be looked after, and I totally get that. But I think there is a skewed prioritisation in the narrative. And there is a sense around this that has been built around it that it can be fixed with money, that everything can be fixed with money. And I don't see it like that.
And so, in specifics, what's the biggest critique? What should they have done more over the last decade?
Well, there's a very simple... There was a great report last year by Eilish Kelly on behalf of the ESRI when she set out all of the challenges around the that intercounty players face. She did also set out all the benefits that come from it. But in the middle of it, she raised the question about the amount of training that was done, its purpose and its practice, and that the key relationship in an intercounty player's life was with an intercounty manager. So I would really question whether the GPA has looked at that idea, has looked at that issue. And there's very little evidence that they have.
Should they have done more to give the Club Players Association a leg up, got behind them, got involved with them? They could have driven that through, couldn't they?
I think that they have walked away from the club player, and that means, of course, walking away from their own membership in respect of that part of their existence, which is the club player. They have repeatedly expressed this view that they're there to represent intercounty players, but intercounty players are also players.
I think this is just flying a kite, isn't it?
It's kite flying.
They don't need that extra meeting.
There is absolutely no way that the GAA, if it's in its right mind at all, having raised ticket prices disgracefully, by the way, raised ticket prices disgracefully, there is no way that they will now hand over €1 million of that to the GPA.
I was surprised. I don't know. Was it the best thing for the GPA in coming out saying we need more money? Like, do they really need another million?
Well, they're doing well out of Boston as well every year. Run a dinner, make $1 million, bring it home.
And what sense did you get from the Offaly players when it came to their interaction with the GPA? Did they feel like it was there for them? Did they feel like it was a very valuable organisation for them?
I have to say I don't know. For the couple of months that I was doing it, it was pedal to the floor. We were focused on playing football.
Top of your agenda.
It wasn't. I think that's in a longer term span, of course, that would then become a conversation. But I think from the time that I was there, I mean, I had nothing but good relations with the players that I was dealing with, and very good relations with the county board. And there were very good relations between the footballers of Offaly and the Offaly County Board while I was there. So I can't see that there would have been a problem.
On the football front, there's a standout piece on Jackie Carey in the Mail on Sunday. Philip Quinn has done this. It's 100 years since his birth. I think that's the reason off the top of my head. You have it there in front of you, Declan.
Yeah.
It's an anniversary.
It's a great piece. I mean, he's this extraordinary figure, Jackie Carey.
Which is it?
Who cares? It's just Johnny. Let's call him Jackie Carey.
He's been called both in various quarters.
Johnny in England and Jackie in Ireland, or the other way around. I'm not sure. But
So for people, and there'll be unfortunately plenty listening who may never even have heard of Jackie Carey. Who was he?
Well, mainly he was a great star for Manchester United in the kind of throughout the 40s, like the Second World War, you know, interrupted his career hugely. If that isn't a terrible reflection on the Second World War there, that one of the great knock-on effects was that it disrupted Jackie Carey's career. But it's He really managed Ireland. He managed a lot of other teams as well. He was this kind of iconic, a kind of complete professional player who looked like almost an authority figure. Like he was balding, you know. Yeah. This is the image I always have in my head of him. He was like a mature person, even when he probably was about 18. He just always seemed to be one of these people who was always bald.
Yeah.
And who was just a great... He's remembered particularly for the fact that he actually signed up with the King's Own Hussars during the war. He went... for an Irish person, that would have been, I'm sure, quite controversial at the time. But Eamon Dunphy is quoted here as saying... you know, the Jackie Carey's own quote was, "A country that gives me my living is worth fighting for." Mm. He said, ahead of his posting as a sergeant to Algeria, Egypt and Italy, where he became known as Kerio when he guested for local clubs. And Eamon Dunphy is quoted, "It was a shining example of courage and a noble thing to do, as Carey could easily have avoided it." Mm. It was hugely important for Irish people in England and those that followed him. As captain of Manchester United, he did nothing but good for Ireland's reputation. And he was manager of Ireland then at that bizarre period when the team was picked by the
committee,
the Big Five, yeah, as they were called, which could conceivably include like a butcher from Sligo or someone. Now, someone who had no knowledge of football at all, other than he kind of liked it. Mm. And these guys would pick the team, and then Jackie Carey would say, "Now you manage it," right? Mm. The team would come over on a Saturday evening or a Sunday, or you know, even on the Sunday morning, or you know, so like they would meet up in the Gresham, yeah, on the morning, and Jackie Carey would say something to them like, "Fizz it about, lads," right? Literally, that was his fizz it, because he had no time to do anything else, and they would fizz it about. And then they would go home usually defeated. He also, in his later career, he was manager of Everton.
Right.
When he became forever associated with a phrase in football, he was sacked in the back of a taxi, right? Famously, one of the directors of Everton, he was in a taxi with Jackie Carey, and he sacked him in the taxi, right? And since then, if a manager is sacked, it's taxi for... whoever, Margot Silva.
Is that where it comes
from? Yeah, that's
from?
Where it comes from. Perhaps his most lasting contribution of all is this. Was Jackie Carey the man who was first sacked in the back of a taxi. So that's where it comes from.
I've heard that phrase forever. It's just such a football phrase. Yeah. That's where it comes from.
It's a great piece of Philip Quinn. Interestingly, the picture that adorns it, it's like Manchester United, and there's a player called Alan B. Chilton. Mm-hmm. Good Lord, what a name. Isn't that a great name? I'd never heard of this before. Alan B. Chilton.
Yeah. So he was, captain under Matt Busby for seven seasons, before the Busby Babes and everything. Mm. And it was...
he was Footballer of the Year.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They won the league, they won the cup.
Yeah, so they won the league in 52.
Yeah.
Because they'd finished runners-up for the previous five seasons. But it opens amazingly. So just after the 1958 Munich air disaster, Jackie Carey at this stage is the manager of Blackburn Rovers. But he drives to Matt Busby's house when he hears of the... crash. And then it says Carey appeared on television as the Manchester United spokesman, and then he flew to Germany to be with the survivors. So it shows the standing is held in that when this unbelievable moment happens, Carey is still sort of such a part of the fabric at the club that he becomes the spokesman and flies out to Munich. And as you said, he was a player of the year, player's player of the year by a landslide in 1949, the runaway winner of the Footballer of the Year award. He pulled in 40% of the votes at the time. Mm. He received the award in London on a Friday and then caught the overnight sleeper with Busby for a game against Newcastle the next day, which United won 1-0. Carey was man of the match. And in 49, he led the Republic of Ireland to that famous 2-0 win over England at Goodison. Mm-hmm. John Giles is kind of quoted in this and basically says that everyone knew one name, and that was Carey's. Carey was the man, he was the star, went to United, had such pace and skill that he started off as a striker, and Busby even played him at fullback as well. Great control. And there's a brilliant anecdote from a game in 1953 when he goes in goals against Sunderland. There were no subs left, or allowed rather, and Carey had to go in goals. And instead of bouncing the ball, he soloed it as if it was a Gaelic football, as his little pre-kick routine to everybody's amusement. They weren't too sure what he was doing. So Jackie Carey.
Yeah, Jeffrey Green of the Times is quoted here, and it kind of sums it all up. He said, "No man was more deserving than Johnny Carey, a model captain and among the most complete and versatile footballers in history. At first glance, with his thinning hair and thoughtful expression, he looked older than his true age, but there was no doubting his maturity. From the moment he led his side out, you got the impression he was bringing a pack of schoolboys who were to be put through their paces cases under his supervision. There was something in his measured, stately tread that engendered an instant feeling of respect and authority.
Yeah. He played for the North as well, did he?
He did. He won 29 caps for what became known as the Republic of Ireland and won 9 caps for what became known as Northern Ireland. But when he played for them, both teams were known as Ireland.
Okay.
Do you want the lecture?
I'll take the abridged notes. I would take the full lecture. The clock is killing us. Conor O'Shea is waiting patiently to take a phone call soon.
Yeah.
So I'll take the spark notes.
In 1922, the Football Association of the Irish Free State has split away from the Irish Football Association, which had been based in Belfast. For the next 35 years, both associations field international teams called Ireland. Mm. Both of whom claiming jurisdiction to pick players from both parts of the Ireland. So when Jackie Carey played for Ireland against England, he played 3 days previously for England against both Ireland teams within 3 days against England. Basically, that's what they. So off across his career 9 times.
Yeah, right.
He played for them, and this continued until the 1950s. This tradition of being able to play for both parts.
Did lots of
Ireland.
Players do it?
Yeah, there's a lot. There's more than 30 players.
Was it a contentious thing to do?
It was seen to be fine, and that's what I'm saying about identity and people being willing to make compromises.
He's from Dunleary in Dublin, so he.
Yes, but also he's also getting paid to play play a football match at a time when the wages being earned by professional footballers are brutal. So most of them have summer jobs. So they work as carpenters or painters or whatever during the summer. Mm-hmm. And in the case of it ended in the 50s because Northern Ireland began to compete in World Cup qualifying campaigns in the 50s, just as the Republic had done from the 1930s. And FIFA basically, this rule came, you couldn't represent two different teams in the same competition.
Yeah.
So an agreement was brokered.
Okay. Very interesting. So that's pages 88 and 89 of the Mail on Sunday. It's a really good piece, and it's the anniversary, 100 year anniversary of his birth. He was born 100 years ago this week in Dunleary, and started off at Home Farm. That's Philip Quinn there. He went to United in 1936.
Oh, actually, the mystery of whether in England, Carey was always Johnny, though the English press dubbed him Gentleman John.
Right.
So this is in relation to, is he Johnny or Jackie?
He had a song on the terrace at Old Trafford. Hello, Johnny Carey, you can hear all the girls cry. Hello, Johnny Carey, you're the apple of my eye. You're a decent boy from Ireland. There's no one can deny. You're a harum scarum, devil may care him, decent Irish boy.
Yeah.
That's good.
Not quite the terrace chant of today.
No, not quite. There you go. Right, we're running out of time, unfortunately. I knew this was going to happen. It was a slightly tight one today. We may not have time to get to Fergus Slattery's piece, which is interesting on a few fronts, but it is worth mentioning Noel McCabe if we're sticking with football and Manchester United connections for a second. This is on page 4 of the Sunday Times. It's a really good idea. This is the guy, Noel McCabe, scout around Dublin. This is the guy who spotted Roy Keane in that very famous game, Fairview, when they got walloped 4-0. And as I only found out recently, Stephen Kenny was playing it.
Oh, yeah.
Just to add to the myth of this game. And Keane, as he said himself in his autobiography, I played for myself. Even when I knew the game was lost, I kept going. I was like a man possessed. He was angry because the bus had been late and it was ramshackle Rovers. So it was Cove against Belvedere. And standing behind the goal in Fairview, it says, Noel McCabe realised he had discovered a buried treasure. Mm. And that's how it kicks off. So there's a great picture of Noel McCabe here. Were you familiar with Noel McCabe going around Dublin back in the day?
Not really. No, I mean, like, I'm aware of him. Like, but what comes out in that as well is the great saga of like players who didn't sign for Liverpool,
Which is what you're focused on.
Yeah, like Peter Schmeichel, I think, offered to come over for free, like, to do a trial, but they said, "Ah, no, that's okay, that's all right." But the one that's added to it now, I didn't realize John O'Shea. Mm. Steve Highway came over to see him, and Liverpool were going to sign him, but they didn't like the fact that Noel McCabe points out that because O'Shea was like very tall, you know, it seemed that he wasn't jumping for a ball that Highway felt he should have jumped for, you know. And I guess the point McCabe was made that O'Shea didn't need to jump for it because he was tall enough. But on that basis, they decided not to sign him. So one more added there to the list. Robbie Keane didn't sign for Liverpool of his own volition.
Yeah.
He decided that he needed to start off earlier on. So in that one article, we have two more added to the extraordinarily long list of really good players who didn't sign for Liverpool.
Yeah, the ball comes in the air. O'Shea 6 foot two, 6 foot three. He doesn't jump for it. Highway was sitting alongside me. He did that in Melwood too. We can't take him.
May I explain
how difficult might it be to teach a fella to jump if you felt that strongly about it?
I don't think that's what they're saying.
Go on.
I think they're saying, I think the point is that he's not aggressive enough.
Yeah.
They wanted what they were looking for. Something. Yeah.
Like Neil Ruddock maybe.
They didn't think, they wanted him to play as an attack the ball regardless of the circumstances.
Well, he says, Joe Corcoran, who has since died, he was the Man United scout. He got Ferguson to have a look at O'Shea. The rest is history.
Yeah. Well, Jay Spearing, he was quite aggressive, right? And he was the only player, I think, that the Liverpool Academy produced for about 10 years after Michael Owen and Steven Gerrard. So, yeah, aggression, yeah, is a good thing. But there's other things as well, you know?
Yeah. Curtis Fleming, he says. It's funny, isn't it?
I think this is brilliant.
Yeah.
I think it's brilliant because he's making the point about how subjective this is.
Yeah.
And that, you know, what that somebody can see something that other people can't. And he said he looked at Curtis Fleming and he just couldn't see any use in him at all. And Curtis Fleming went on to play, what, 200-300 games for Middlesbrough and 10 caps for Ireland.
10 caps for Ireland, 2-6 experiences for Middlesbrough. He made a great career for himself. I never rated him. I knew all about him. We just didn't send him for any trials.
I still don't think actually he was much good.
Almost on the point of saying that, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a nice point with Keane, because Keane talks about McCabe in his book a good bit and you know sings his praises and said that he felt like McCabe was a very genuine man and that he could trust him right from the start and met him at the Ashton Hotel near Houston and sent him on his way to Forest. He only met him once afterwards, he says. There was a friendly against Dundalk and they were running for a bus. Ronnie Fenton says, hurry up, Roy, we're all going. So I just said a quick hello, best of luck. That was it, and he never really saw him again. But then, at the very end of the piece, when McCabe was in hospital, he got a get well card out of the blue, Roy Keane, which is a nice touch, isn't it?
Yeah, you hear quite a few of these stories of Roy Keane, if you like, being privately quite a different person than what a lot of people assume that he's like in his public persona.
Yeah. Now, welcome back. We're reviewing the Sunday papers. We have Paul Rouse and Declan Lynch here in the studio. We're just finishing off chatting about Noel McCabe, the scout who spotted Roy Keane way back when. And you brought up Peter Schmeichel. And then, Paul, you just mentioned in the ad break you saw Peter Schmeichel's first game for
Peter Schmeichel, I was living in Manchester at the time and I used to go to stand in the Stretford End, all the home matches.
Was it easy to get a ticket back then?
Yeah, just walk up. I didn't have a ticket. Just walk up and pay at the gate.
Wow.
£6, £6.50.
So we're talking early 90s there.
We're talking 1991, 92, that time.
Walk up and get a ticket on the day?
Yeah, no problem.
Man, that is extraordinary.
I used to actually go down there early on the Saturday. I'd meet people who were over from Tullamore. Every week you'd run into somebody at the ground who was going over to a game. So I saw... So that season matches, he was just magnificent. Even in the warm-ups, he just brought an energy to the warm-ups that was the mark of just a different level of player. Just really demanding of people around them, setting a tone around the place. Mm. And he got the crowd going because he warmed up in front of the Stretford End every time and you knew he was totally up for it.
Were you in Manchester long enough to see the period where the walking up and paying in changed?
No, I was gone. I was gone from there. I haven't been back since.
It's definitely changed since... Then I wonder when it did change. It couldn't have been long after 1992.
No,
you must have got the last halcyon days of being able to wander up.
Well, yeah, like according to legend, that not only did Schmeichel, he as a young player, wrote to Liverpool and asked them, could he please have a trial?
Yeah.
Please, because he's a huge Liverpool fan. And he begged them and he begged them and they said no. I think Cantona, according to legend, Cantona was offered to Liverpool. Who very wisely, you know, turned that one down as well. Those two decisions, right? Not just of what it might have meant for Liverpool, but against United. Like, is that the whole difference? Maybe
it's a 6-point swing. That's for sure.
It's some 6 points. It's a 6-year swing, isn't it? You know,
6 years of your life.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the knock on to get over to another 6 years. It's like an 18-year swing, really, isn't it? You know.
You were saying that you are taking it one day at a time at the moment.
Yeah, with as regards winning the league this year, it's that's all any of us do. Like we are exhausted trying to work out the various permutations. But my own view is, if you could boil it down to one thing, it's Firmino. If Bobby Firmino kind of recovers his best form consistently, I think that one thing would make all the difference. Because any time Liverpool are not good, it's usually he's not. He's such an important player, and he's such a brilliant player that maybe he's not being played in the right position or whatever. Like he needs to kind of, it's like Salah is in the middle and he's in the way, you know, that he gets the ball, he's not sure where to go with it, right? But he's so good. I think Klopp always has regarded him as crucial. You'd often hear him at times of saying the first player he mentions is Firmino, that he sees him as so important to the whole way the team works, that if he, like, you know, we could talk about many permutations. That's the one thing I think, that if he gets it, if he comes back into form consistently, then I think we could go close, you know. That's all I'd say.
Okay. There's bits of rugby. There's not a huge amount, obviously, given it's a gap week in the Six Nations. But one piece that caught our eye, Fergus Slattery. Fergus Slattery remains as combative as ever when talking about the modern game and Ireland's current dip in form. Peter O'Reilly talking to Fergus Slattery, who turned 70 last Tuesday. Phil Bennett called him a remarkable player. He was one of the standout players on that Lions tour of South Africa in 74. He said, Slats used to do sprint training with the backs on tour. He'd be annoyed if he finished second or third. Such a competitor, a good footballer too. An open-side flanker back in his day. Played in 15 consecutive Five Nations Championships, which is one more than Rory Best. And he's still combative, as Peter Riley says. On the England game, a disaster. Our performance was absolutely crap. On the victory over Scotland, fair, but no more than fair. We made lots of mistakes. Like our scrum half could have run behind the post when he scored. Why didn't he? We missed the conversion and it could have been critical. What the F, says Slattery. And O'Reilly says that he was in Edinburgh last week, and on the Friday he addressed a large crowd at the Wooden Spoon charity lunch. And he told them he had the utmost contempt for the Scottish and Welsh unions for their failure to support Ireland's World Cup bid, and also for their refusal to send teams to Dublin in 1972. So he is a man comfortable in his own opinions, Slattery, which is no bad thing. He definitely, the trip to South Africa during the apartheid era comes up, he's definitely not hemming and hawing or drowning in self-doubt over the decision to go. He was one of the players that went. Obviously he went with the Lions. He said, I was anti-apartheid. I felt the best way to change this was through communication. For instance, I captained the Lions against the Proteas, the first non-white side to play the Lions. They had an 18-year-old centre. 7 years later, when Ireland toured there, he became the first non-white to wear the Springbok jersey. That would have really hurt the Broderbond, the inner sanctum of Afrikanderdom. On these tours, I often disappeared and explored the townships, always brought a journalist with me in case anything went wrong. He talked about going to see several places with Colm Smith of the Irish Independent. I genuinely wanted to understand what the whole society was about, how the whole thing wasn't working. The decision of those players to go to South Africa around that time, I wasn't around at the time. Certainly there was plenty of rancour at the time, but it hasn't aged well. I don't know, do you put much stock or validity in that argument that he makes?
I think he makes his case very well. But the reality of it is that I don't doubt, by the way, that Fergus Slattery is utterly anti-racist.
And sorry, I, in fairness to him, I should read that. I was anti-apartheid and I felt the best way to change things was through communication, just to emphasise that.
Yeah, I don't doubt for a minute that he was against the apartheid regime. Nobody, you can't begin second-guessing that. But the reality of it is that for all that he makes a good case for himself, he's found himself on the wrong side of history on this one. And it's all very well saying that I wanted to go and find out about the society and I wanted to go and do this. The Irish anti-apartheid movement had been in existence since the middle of the 1960s, since about 1964. Mm-hmm. There had been a series of protests every time the South Africans had visited Ireland throughout the 1970s. Nobody could be in any doubt about what was going on here. There was a broader call for sporting isolation of these, and this was particularly focused on the Springboks team. And the idea that the Springboks team was in some way evocative and supportive of that regime. It was emblematic of that regime. The protests here were immense in the 1970s. There were also, by the way, and you can find this in the National Archives, there is a series of exchanges between the government, file after file of this, of exchanges between the government and the Irish Rugby Football Union, in which government, succession of government ministers are basically trying to say, look,
don't do this.
Don't do this. There's no need for this. And the IRFU are basically saying, we'll do whatever we want, and we know best. And this is sport, and sport goes beyond the politics of this particular time, and rugby transcends everything here.
Yeah.
And it's a very convenient position to take. But if the way I'd frame this up is very straightforward. A group of people who were working in Dunn stores in the middle of the 1980s knew enough to go on strike because, well, they were a strike. It ended up being a lockout over the fact that they wouldn't handle South African produce.
Yeah.
So that's how deeply this had percolated around society. So it just feels convenient to argue it in that way. Now, again, I don't say for a minute that he wasn't anti-apartheid or that he wasn't anti-racist, but when you have a broader movement calling for you not to offer any support for this institution, for this racialized society, then
it trumps your own personal desire to go and learn about a country. Maybe maybe go and do that not under the banner of the Irish rugby.
And given how articulate Fergus Slattery is, what if Fergus Slattery had come out and spoken so strongly and so critically around that time? How transformative would that have been?
The 1981 tour was especially contentious. I just was briefly looking back there. So Charles Haughey wrote a letter to the RFU saying, don't go on tour. And then they obviously went. And then the president at the time, Patrick Hillary, didn't attend the Ireland-Australia game the following November, again by way of protest. Obviously, several players didn't go. Hugh McNeil, Donald Spring, Tony Ward, and a few others didn't go. But it was incredibly contentious. And this the Gleneagles agreement was kind of 1977. Which was a huge number of countries coming together and saying we can't engage with South Africa in these terms.
It's just a line that kind of sticks out here about it. I often disappeared and explored the townships.
Yeah.
That I always brought a journalist with me just in case anything went wrong. I've read that line a few times. I mean, naturally, we're the sort of people who you want if something goes wrong in the townships. What I need, I need a journalist beside me at all times when those things are going on. Yeah, sure.
Well, it's one part of the interview anyway. I was curious to know if you felt there was any strength in that argument, but clearly not, given the climate at the time. He talks about the amateur days as well. He's drinking six pints the night before a game?
Yeah, 6 pints the night before, and no bother on them, apparently, you know. But I guess the whole thing that comes through is the rugby guys do what the rugby guys want to do, you know, and we'll kind of just justify it. I mean, he also gave up the drink. He said the 6 pints would have zero impact the following day. He said, I wouldn't have done it otherwise. I could drink forever. Then 17 years ago, I just gave up alcohol. I just had enough.
He's not a fan of the modern game either. He can't stand the constant one-out bashing, pass, smash, for 27 phases until someone knocks it on. That's boring.
The problem with it is that if you watch a video of a rugby match from 40, 50 years ago, it doesn't often make for a pleasant viewing.
No,
you get sucked into a highlights reel where the Barbarians are turning around, or Welsh are scoring or whatever, and you get selected moments, but there are so much of it was dross.
Just manic and dross. Yeah. He does concede the skill sets are completely different now. He does say that.
Wasn't Slats involved in the famous try, try against the Babas? No, for the Babas against...
He was.
Whoever they were playing. Remember the legendary try with Gareth Ed...
From the end of the world?
Yeah.
Is it that one? Oh, no, that's the French one. There are a few tries from the
most
of the world?
Famous that used to be on the start of the grandstand. You know,
right.
The most Gareth Edwards scored in the corner. It was this extraordinary try, but Slats was in there, wasn't he? In that, you know, it was like the most famous try.
Those Living with Lions series are obviously great, and the political discussion aside that we've had on that South African tour.
You haven't imagined how impressed you are that the Babas. I could call them the Babas so easily.
No, you know? I am impressed. You know, on that tour in 1974 in South Africa, he was a phenomenon. He really was. It's the footage. He was just outrageously good. And we had Ian McGeegan in here a couple of years ago, and he was just talking about how phenomenal he was at the time. Like, we're talking about an unbelievable player in his day. Interestingly, he says when kids came along and he had to start working very hard and everything else, he said, from 1975 until 1984, I played in third gear. just matter of fact about it, you know. Mm.
No, he was a great player. I mean, I remember vaguely as a kid, like, and he was so distinctive, you know. At a time when, to me, it just looked like 50 or 30 people having a fight. Like, you could still see this kind of individual flying around the place with hair, long hair and stuff like that, you know. So, he was clearly a great player. Mm.
That's in the Sunday Times. Is there anything else that anyone wants to direct people towards? There's a piece on Caster Semenya, which is, like, it's really complicated stuff.
Yeah.
And it's generally better done in the hands of, like, a Ross Tucker or someone on who really knows what they're talking about. But basically, the Semenya decision is up for... it was appealed, and it's going to be decided this week, basically. In short, Semenya and the South African Athletics Association have appealed to CAS, and the case is going to be heard this week, and it's going to have huge ramifications for women's sport. David Walsh is writing in favour of restoring the rule whereby Semenya and others who are in a similar boat to her have to take suppressants for the level of testosterone in their body. Ross Tucker's been on the show talking about it a few times before. It's unbelievably complicated area, and you're into science that very few of us can get our heads around. But they're going to make what will be close to a final decision on it this week. So that's actually really worth looking out for. And you can read Devin Walsh talking about it today. And then, I mean, the next frontier is, and several people in the IAAF have mentioned it, that there may well have to be a transgender division very, very soon as well in the next 5 to 10 years, maybe sooner. So it's very complicated business. I'm sure the scientists out there will be interested in that. I don't know, are you on top of it or following it closely?
No.
That's fair enough.
I couldn't say either.
I won't put you on the spot.
I couldn't say either yes to either of those questions.
Yeah.
And again, it very briefly, it's something that doesn't just sit in the world of sport. This is a wider societal issue as well. And in terms of sport, though, the medicalization of sport in general and the role of drugs in sport and all the testing that goes on and everything that this throws up, it's, again, not entirely unrelated to that. And just as it is with the rules around identity and who you play for, this is, again, exceptionally difficult to legislate for around the margins. And except in this case, and in cases like this, it cuts right to the core of a person's identity. Mm. It goes way beyond something as comparatively superficial as national identity. Mm. But your very core of your being, the essence of your humanity, is revealed in this.
Mm. Yeah. It's on the back page of the Sunday Times if you want to get started reading on it. And there's going to be a decision this week. But to be honest, this is the latest in a long line of situations where Semenya came on the scene and she beat everybody around her. And then the IAAF said that females with male levels of testosterone could not compete in women's races. And that was in 2015. And so then she had a year or two where she wasn't winning races, and then that was appealed and it was overturned. And then she's had a period where she has been winning races, and now it's been overturned again. Where they are at the moment, basically, is that CAS have asked the IAAF to go away and to come back and prove just how important testosterone is when it comes to performance. That's the kind of real layman's version. Now, Ross Tucker said it's ludicrous they were asked to do this because it's so obvious that testosterone plays a massive role. But the IAAF are going to go and make their case. But equally, South Africa are appealing to CAS as well. So it's very legal as well. And the problem people seem to have, or the difficulty, is where do you draw the line? And it becomes unbelievably complicated. I think we'll leave it to people who know more about it than us. We'll do something about it on the show this week. Anything else you want to point anyone towards as we begin to wrap up?
Well, isn't this the big test for Ole Gunnar?
Oh, yeah. Well, back page there of the Sunday World are saying he has the job, that Ed Woodward met with him for 3 hours, and that his people are saying they're pretty confident they have it. Obviously, there's Chelsea tomorrow and Liverpool to come next week, but he seems to think, regardless of what happens there, he's going to have the job now, but who knows?
Yeah, I haven't made up my mind about that one yet, but I marginally favour them, you know, Gunnar being the new boss.
As a Liverpool fan, he wants to see them implode, or just speaking neutrally?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You think Solskjaer shouldn't get it then?
There's something about him, and is it Michael Carrick sitting beside him? I know there's something, I find something reassuring about that I can't quite put my finger on. You know?
As a Liverpool fan?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was funny, but I used to see Phil Neville sitting beside Moisey. I know some, I had never felt reassured by anything about imagining the time of Ferguson, but something strangely reassuring. What the one thing I fear on this is that when I see Ole Gunnar there, what I really see is Ferguson.
Yeah, Mike, you know, Mike Phelan.
Did Fergie say something like, you know, what a great job he's doing, or that? Yeah, I think he made some endorsement of him.
I don't know if he's done it publicly, but behind the scenes, they're saying here in this piece by Ken Lawrence, Ferguson is absolutely of the opinion it should be Solskjaer.
Yeah. So that's the one bit that I'm slightly kind of concerned about, you know, because really their only solution is to have Fergie back again.
Yeah.
So the nearest thing to...
It makes you feel better. Ferguson also said they should have Moyes.
I think this is, again, the very fact of having this conversation is the ultimate proof that Man United have turned into post-1992 Liverpool. The series of mistakes that Liverpool made, the as you say, running down the academy or the not producing players... Liverpool brought a succession of some of the most mediocre defenders who were matched only by the mediocrity of their midfielders during this period. And you can just see United going exactly down the same road. What was the name of the Brazilian? Was it Emerson that Man United bought in the summer?
Anderson.
Yeah. Anderson.
The
guy who bought, they bought this summer.
We haven't seen him in
months. He seems to be...
It's just an odd thing with a club that happened with Liverpool, which is that just once a club becomes dysfunctional...
Yeah,
it tends to sort of, you know, it can't stand up for falling down. It just some weird thing gets into the system that, you know, so you start turning down Peter Schmeichel and turning away Eric Cantona and turning down John O'Shea, and it just seems to kind of be the kind of, you know, all the great decisions that were made seem to always turn into bad decisions. So
not that money cures everything, but I did almost suspect that United wouldn't quite go all the way down to the Liverpool level. The parallel is definitely there, but just that being the richest club in the world or thereabouts would insulate them somehow. But it doesn't seem to be the case. You still need really good decisions to be made.
And I don't think it would matter so much if turning down Peter Schmeichel or turning down wouldn't matter so much if you were getting 95% of the rest of the stuff right.
Yeah,
sure.
But with Man United, I mean, they've made a succession of, like, some of the players they bought. Like, Rojo has a good World Cup for Argentina. Yeah. Next thing, he's in the Man United squad.
That's classic Liverpool. That's El Hadji Diouf, you know.
Exactly.
You know, again, boiling things down to the simplest, all that's happened at Liverpool in the last few years, they just stopped signing bad players. You know, they've signed really good players. Most of them have turned out really well.
Yeah.
And it's as simple as that, you know. More or less all the players United have signed have in some way failed or been... or have got worse, got dramatically worse, and it's just a weird thing. It just when things start going like that, they tend to keep going like that. Now it's been 6 years, and maybe they're due to
turn
kind of stop going, like, because as you say, they're so powerful and they've got so much money.
Yeah, that, can cover over a lot of bad
there's
mistakes.
Almost nothing. Yeah, that they can turn around. But still,
fellas, thanks a million for coming in. So we had Paul Rouse from the School of History at UCD, author of Sport in Ireland History as well, and former Offaly manager. We can say that, can't we?
That's fine.
No, we can, yeah. And Declan Lynch as well, from the Sunday Independent, author of Tony 10, which, as we mentioned at the very top, is out in paperback form sometime around Cheltenham. Gents, thanks a million. We'll take a break.
Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.